Watch this.
Let's do this. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast, brought to you in partnership with our friends over at FootJoy. I am Tom Mills, and today I'm joined by my esteemed colleague and historian friend, Bruce Fitzpatrick. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you for that overblown intro.
It's all right. I thought I'd go hard on the back. Yeah. Did you do history at uni?
I did back in the day, but I feel like I've just, slowly, maybe not so slowly, maybe rapidly just lost all the historical knowledge that I tried to take in.
All the rigor of history.
Yeah, I know. You just sort of, I've just become a...
Come in handy today, though.
Well, golf history, I feel like it's a sort of a dark art, really, isn't it? You know, sort of storytelling, anecdotes, a little bit of truth and a healthy amount of speculation and conjecture.
I think there'll be a healthy amount of what's said today. I would take, I think, with a proverbial pinch of salt. We've each gone away and researched three or four things about the Masters. Obviously, with the Masters coming up, starting on Thursday, par three contest on Wednesday. So we've each gone away and done a little bit of digging into maybe some of the idiosyncrasies or the history or tradition of the Masters, and we've come together to talk about our things. Now, I think I'll start with Bruce. What have you chosen to research?
So I thought I'd focus my efforts around three topics. The first one was just sort of the early history and maybe the myth of the Masters, which I appreciate is quite a big topic, but I've sort of done some reading around that. I've also looked at some of the great amateurs, given that, the Masters is the sort of patron saint of Augusta National is the great Bobby Jones. I thought it'd be fitting to talk about some of the amateurs. Amateur performances at the event over the years. And then my third topic, which I thought was maybe a bit of a strange one, but for some reason, having watched that event since I was growing up, I've always felt that there's usually some sort of bizarre rules incident that comes up year on year. And so I thought I'd just look at the famous rulings over the years at Augusta. So there you go. Those are my three areas. What about yourself, Tom? What are you looking at?
I went into five areas. One of them we may or may not touch upon. The one we may or may not touch upon is the evolution of the course, which I'm happy to bin. But I would urge anyone, all my research was done through the evaluating website put together by Jasper Miners and Joe McDonald. It's a wonderful piece on the evolution of Augusta National. And there are bits in there that I really didn't know. I mean, if we get into it, it'll be interesting. I've got a feeling, because you started on the history, that we might delve into it a little bit. So I did the evolution of the course. I did the champions dinner. I did honorary tee shots.
Oh yeah.
The green jacket and the par three contest. So I thought I would dig into some little idiosyncrasies of the contest. Well, I wanted to delve into why they're called patrons, but I thought there was just something I'd get too lost down and not find an answer. Niche. Did you come up with this in your research? Why they're patrons?
Yeah. I didn't actually touch on that, but Clifford Roberts, who is someone we'll talk about a bit, when we look at the early history of the course and the event, was known for sort of being probably quite a kind of, I don't know what the description would be, quite sort of, I don't know, interesting and sort of unique in the way he probably approached it. And I imagine he would have had something to do with it. If I was to guess, he probably would have had some involvement in making sure that the word patron was used over fan or spectator.
Clifford Roberts is an interesting bloke. And it appears to me that he ruled the roost with an iron fist. I mean, for those people that don't know anything about, you're going to touch on the history of it, so Clifford Roberts is going to come up a lot. Tell us a little bit about you know, where it all started, because I'm sure Clifford Ops is going to come up in this story.
Yeah, so there's been a little bit more, you know, sort of description and kind of input on the historical side, I think, in recent years. I think it's fair to say Augusta National did a brilliant job of presenting this great image of like, you know, growth and kind of, you know, just where this, the idea of an event that's played at the same place every year, I think it allows you to drill down on some of the great stories and characters from over the years, in a way that, you know, dare I say, the Open is obviously the oldest major championship, but because it moves around so much, I don't think you have that chance to maybe look at things thematically in the way that we're hopefully going to do now in this podcast. And I think it all really starts with the great man, Bobby Jones. Obviously, you know, I think we've covered it a fair few times on this podcast already, what a prolific champion he was in the game. And famously, he remained an amateur. You know, professionally, he was a lawyer. And at the age of 28, he basically walked away from professional golf, having achieved the career Grand Slam in 1930.
When you say professional golf, do you mean kind of competitive?
Competitive,
golf?
I should say. Sorry, that was a terrible misspeak. That was a terrible
we don't like to let things fly on the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast.
Yeah. So no, he was professionally a lawyer, but, you know, a prolific winner of the biggest events in the game, beating professionals. And he walked away from that competitive side after, you know, the crowning achievement of the Grand Slam, winning the US Amateur, US Open, the Amateur and the Open, which we call the British Am and the British Open in America. You know, won all those in 1 year in 1930 and then decided to walk away from the competitive side and bought the property which Augusta National sits on today in 1931, I
want to
say.
Okay, so fairly close.
Yeah.
You know, fairly close to finishing the Grand Slam.
Yeah, pretty, I mean, the year after, really. It was known as the Fruitland Nursery. Yeah, there's quite a good little video, actually, that Noel Engup did with the historian Michael Wolfe on the early days of Augusta National and the kind of property, changing the property ownership there that led to Jones and Clifford Roberts, and I think there were a couple of other people involved in the acquisition of the site, which was known as the Fruitland Nurseries and previously known by the Berkman family. It was then passed on to a chap called J. Perry Stoltz, I believe, who was a kind of hotelier and had these visions for a resort-style golf course. He then fell into financial difficulty, and that was what led to Jones and Roberts acquiring the site. And it really didn't take that long for them to, you know, build the course and get it open for play. I think they started construction in 1931. Great Dr. Alistair McKenzie was obviously famously involved in a lot of the design concepts for the course.
Do we know much about how that happened?
Jones and McKenzie. That's a good, you know, there's not, there doesn't seem to be like loads written from what I can tell on that. I mean, you've obviously looked at the evolution of the course, and I think it's fair to say that it has actually undergone a significant amount of change over the years. Mm. What was your sort of sense of that?
Well, I mean, I think I've read some bits in the past that Jones was very impressed having seen Cypress Point, and that he was, you know, played Cypress Point and was keen to enlist Dr. Alistair McKenzie when he decided to build his course over at Augusta National. Whether it starts and ends there, whether there was more to be written. I mean, I know that Bobby Jones had a great affinity with the old course, great affinity with the old course. And obviously Alistair McKenzie had written extensively about the old course and the spirit of the game, the spirit of St. Andrew, sorry. So, whether, you know, those two things had married up and he got him out there, I'm not sure. But I do, you know, having looked at it, Augusta's a very strange one because obviously it was designed by McKenzie and Bobby Jones. How much of that is left? You know, you could argue there's not a ton of that left. But so we know that we get Alistair McKenzie involved. Early days, 1931-ish, straight after the purchase. What happens after? So what goes through? How does Clifford Roberts get to be involved?
Well, this is what I find quite funny, just to circle back on the point there. When you look at those early pictures of it, it's striking is just how open it is.
Yeah.
And whereas now it's all, when you look at it on TV, it seems that each hole is like its own unique kind of enclosed, tranquil sort of thing. And but actually, when you look at the early aerial photographs, it looks wide open. And as you touched upon there, you know, there's a huge influence that St Andrews has in both the mind of Mackenzie and Jones. As for Clifford Roberts, well, he was a very successful investment banker from New York who got to know Bobby Jones. I think really, I mean, Bobby Jones was in the peak of his powers in the 20s, and they encountered one another, I think, on several occasions. And really, I think Jones's vision for Augusta was that it would be a truly national membership. So in the early days, I think I'm right in saying that they did look to quite a few of the sort of New York elite to try and recruit them as members. And it was a bit patchy, like the uptake in members for Augusta early on was pretty difficult. I mean, obviously,
yeah, it was quite
time,
poor, wasn't it?
Yeah,
were really, really struggling to. In fact, I think it's common knowledge that the Masters itself was essentially a membership drive.
Yeah. Yeah, like a marketeer sort of marketeering exploit. And, you know, we mentioned sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek about Clifford Roberts, and maybe he had something to do with the use of the word patron instead of fan or spectator. And there is a sense that, like, there was a real, deliberate intention to try and, create this mystique and this awe around it, especially given that, you know, time of the Great Depression, Wall Street crash in 29 and the economic uncertainty after. Like, it's probably not surprising that they did struggle so much to recruit members for this new national golf club. In the early days, Clifford Roberts famously wanted to call it the Masters Tournament, and it was Bobby Jones who objected, and he said, "I think that's too presumptuous and ostentatious." And he called it the Augusta National Invitation Tournament.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was used for the sort of the first 5 years. And then in 1939, I think Jones sort of relented and sort of accepted the change of name to the Masters Tournament. He sort of said, well, yeah, actually, these are the best players. These are the masters of the game who are getting to come and play. And that was it. Yeah. So what's staggering, I think, obviously it's colored by our experience of the present, and there's a lot of great new golf courses that we see and that we're lucky enough to go and get the chance to play that are popping up nowadays. What's striking to me is that, like, Augusta construction started, obviously the site was acquired in 1931, construction started soon thereafter. The course opened for the first few member rounds in like December 1932. Mm. And the formal opening was like January 1933. How quickly that happened, and they had tournament play there in March 1934. Whereas you see, nowadays, even with the advent of loads of new machinery and how much quicker you can move earth, it seems like golf courses take a hell of a lot longer to build, don't they?
Yeah, I think when the land is right, and you know, as you say, there were remarkably fewer trees. I mean, looking back at some of the early pictures of the holes, a lot of these holes were open. There were a couple of trees lining fairways, but they certainly weren't carved out of a forest. Because, when you hear that it's kind of a nursery, or whether its origins are a nursery, in my mind that depicts a kind of a, you know, get in there, it's a tree nursery, it's tear out all these trees and carve out some holes, which I just don't think that was what it was. What was interesting, Bruce, is, I mean, we might as well touch upon the evolution of the course while we're here, but the course was originally, the nines were the other way around for an entire playing season. They started on 10, played through to 18, and then one played through to nine. But that was changed at some point in, I think I've got it in 1933 and 1934, and it hardly raised an eyebrow when it happened. It was released. There was a passage in the Augusta Chronicle that just said it was also announced that the order of play over the course would be changed this year, with the back nine holes and the front nine reversed. Under the new plans, number 10 will become number one, and the old number one will be number 10. The change was decided, officials said, because the first nine holes are more difficult to play than the last nine, and playing the easier holes first will give players more opportunity to warm up before reaching the intricate problems of the difficult holes. Now, That was it in the Augusta Chronicle. That's how they announced it. Just chucked it in the paper. But yeah, they played it the way around for a little bit, which I think they made the right decision. It's pretty iconic now, the back nine of Augusta, isn't it?
Yeah, that crescendo in Amen Corner, you know, famously, a 10 is really hard from you know, what you see with the statistics. And then 11, 12, 13 as well.
Interesting.
A real crescendo, yeah.
10th always plays as the toughest hole on the course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I'm reading this, huge credit goes to Jasper at Evaluate 18 and Joe McDonald, but reading about this, when this was laid out by McKenzie, tons of these are like template holes, but not template holes like a Redan or a Biarritz, although there is a Biarritz or was a Biarritz on the golf course, it's not now. But they're often, you know, there's citations that they were based on holes. Now the 10th at Augusta National was based on a hole that you've played, Bruce. It was based on the 4th at Old Woodley. Which,
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Apparently, or loosely based. Oh, they picked the best bits out of the 4th of Old Woodley, and then there was a hole at Cypress Point. But that was it in its notes. It was
the 4th is at Old Woodley, the long par 4 that comes back.
That's right, yeah. I know. I was equally shocked. There.
Heavily bunkered.
I'm trusting Jasper. I was equally shocked. It's a 102-foot drop in that hole, by the way, in the 10th.
Wow.
They moved it slightly up the hill. They moved the green a little bit further up the hill, so the drop was less severe. But from top to bottom, there's a 102-foot drop.
Wow. It is one of the most dramatic holes there. Obviously, Adam Scott famously won, beat Angel Cabrera, was it, in the playoff? In 2013, and you know, Tiger, I think, beat DeMarco there. It does yield a bit of drama. Rory's collapse, that's where it all started in 2011. I think, I mean, one thing I should have mentioned earlier, and you touched a little bit on McKenzie and his involvement with the club. I think it's relatively well known and accepted that he was owed quite a bit of money by Augusta for having consulted and again, there's that wider context economically about the depression. And, you know, I don't know if it's Clifford Roberts who shouldered most of the blame or whether he and Jones are equally culpable, but they, you know, they did. McKenzie died being owed a fair amount of money by the club, didn't he? And there was interest as well. And I think Golf Club Atlas has sort of covered that in a bit of detail. How much of it, again, we can really definitively confirm being true, because as to whether there were letters written between McKenzie and Clifford Roberts and other figures at Augusta National, it's hard to really to verify that and say for sure. But that does seem to be the kind of overarching theme of him being owed quite a bit of money is a slightly awkward point in the history of Augusta, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but you have to look this through the lens of what it was facing. Like like you say, the Masters started in 1934. The Augusta National Invitational started in 1934. Essentially, like you say, or like I said earlier on, as a kind of a membership drive. It was a publicity stunt to try and get people to join Augusta. They wanted people that were going between New York and Florida and holidaying, you know, in Florida. They wanted people to stop off in Georgia and be a member at this club. And
yeah,
this was about, all, you know, kicking off in 1934. I think it was either the first or the second Augusta Invitational that they didn't even get enough ticket sales to pay the fee. Now, put this through the lens of Alistair McKenzie died in January 1934. So we're not talking about, you know, Augusta National stiffing the architect because they were just like, yeah, you're not having it. This is a club that's struggling. We're not long after the Depression. Yeah. It's a club that's struggling. And I honestly don't think that they were able to, and I think it's documented that Harry Colt helped pay off some of his debts when McKenzie died.
Really? Yeah.
I think Frank Pont told us that a couple of podcasts, maybe 150 yeah. podcasts ago. So yeah, I mean, that is probably a black mark on the history of Augusta National.
Yeah, and I think there's that theme that you just take it for granted now because it is arguably, And I hate to say this, someone who's a stickler for tradition. I love Lynx Golf and the Open, but it's probably fair to say the Masters is the biggest event in golf. And there's this huge amount
I'm
of
gonna
mystique
have to agree
around
with
it.
You. I'm going to have to agree with you.
More so than the Ryder Cup. Slightly different.
Well, but it's the season starter.
Element.
And I think the familiarity of Augusta National is...
And yeah, we see it as this amazingly sort of polished and unique and exclusive elite thing. And yet in the early days, it was one of like real sort of struggle and just trying to get it off the ground. I mean, I'm quite, yeah. I think what comes out with Clifford Roberts, there's really mixed opinions of him. I think it's fair to say, you know, known as you mentioned for kind of ruling things with a bit of an iron fist and quite a lot of secrecy going on. But undoubtedly, even things such as the name, the Masters, we owe that to Clifford Roberts for his sort of effect as a marketeer. And I'm pretty sure there's one of the great quotes is that by 1939, he sort of feels that vindicated and feels like he can say, well, you know, we've created a tournament of such importance that we're just bound to see this through now because, you know, everyone loves it. And you're thinking, well, you're only sort of like 4 or 5 years in, Clifford. Is that slightly lofty?
I know. And he strikes me as a man that absolutely lives and dies like through his conviction. It's just like he was a benevolent dictator and whatever he said went. And he was so transfixed and so determined to make sure that Augusta National would succeed, that it's hard to see how it was ever not going to succeed, really. And I mean, he's done some amazing things, some truly amazing things in the history of Augusta, but he's done some absolutely heinous things as well, like the eighth green. I don't know if you've ever seen the pictures of what he did to the eighth green, which is the, please, for any listener that's interested, look up Clifford Roberts, eighth green, Augusta National. He kind of propped it up maybe, I don't know, a foot and a half up off the ground in a figure of eight. And it just, the whole green was levitated. It was horrendous. It originally had these mounding around it, kind of like it does now, which they got rid of. They raised it and then they raised the green a foot and a half and put this figure of eight thing is. I urge you to look, it's absolutely heinous. But those mounds were reinstated. So he wasn't completely perfect.
And it's probably... right. In the interest of total transparency, you know, the thing that he would be most severely criticized for was his stance on, you know, racial segregation at the club.
Yeah.
You know, the quote, infamous quote about all the golfers being white and all the caddies being black, as long as he was in charge, obviously does go down as a real sort of mark on kind of his legacy at the club.
Agree.
Which is
why it was so, when you know, Tiger came on 97, 98. Yeah. So important.
And he, you know, he'd passed on long before then. You know, he died in 1977. You know, Jones had passed away a few years before. So really the two key figures who had driven that forward, that vision, you know, died in the 70s. But, you know, just to sort of come back to some of the innovations that Clifford Roberts, again, that we maybe take slightly for granted. He did, you know, deliberately kind of move a lot of the perimeter mounds around to improve the gallery viewing there. It's known as, obviously, to this day, being a brilliant spectacle for those who are there, those patrons who are there on the ground. It's probably the best environment, to, you know, whoever you speak to would say it's the best place you could watch golf. He was, you know, one of the first people who kind of designed a series of leaderboards mounted throughout the course. Cumulative score of each player being denoted with red numbers for under par. And
is that him? Was that?
Yeah. So there's, and of course the first broadcast as well, 1956, the Masters is broadcast on CBS. You know, he's very successful in New York and his career in the city. So, you know, it's fair to say that leveraging those connections undoubtedly help the Masters get off to the good start and the strong commercial footing, which is obviously just continues to grow year on year.
It's safe to say that. I mean, as amazing as it is now and as manicured and as kind of perfect as it all is, it, you know, it all could have been undone if not for one shot by Gene Sarazen. It's strange how that one shot on the 15th hole, you know, the shot heard around the world, basically, you know, the albatross on 15, it it just fully established it as the event that it was. It was kind of, up until that point, struggling to agree. It was attracting professionals again, like I said earlier on. They weren't finding it the easiest to kind of run it. But that Sarazen moment really was the turning point of the whole of Augusta, really.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that, because you get a great number of players, and I know this is a shameless plug, but we got to mention it anyway. Blackwell Golf Club obviously has its own little connection with it through William Tweddle, who was opposing Walker Cup captain of Bobby Jones at Chicago Golf Club, and did get the invite to play in the inaugural Masters and be an honorary member of the.
I thought you were going to say that the 12th at Augusta was based on the 13th at Blackwell. Surely,
well, that's a bit more. yeah, slight more conjecture there, but. Yeah, you make a valid point about the best players in the world and just trying to get this established. You mentioned Sarazen's famous albatross. Tell us a little bit about the green jacket and those little quirky traditions that we probably associate the Masters with nowadays. When did that come about?
Yeah, just before I do, because while I'm here, I don't think we're going to come on to the evolution of the course, because I think I've touched it. But what I will say about Mackenzie while we're here, there were quite a few holes that were based on holes. And it's really interesting to look through. And when you're watching the Masters now, just, keep an eye on it and see if you can spot them, because they didn't jump out to me. So apparently the fifth hole was based on the road hole. The sixth hole, there's quite a lot of St. Andrews in here in terms of where he took his inspiration. The sixth hole, which is the par three, the downhill par three, the only hole that's actually got shorter, in the it's gone from 185 to 180, is based on the Redan at North Berwick.
Okay.
What else have we got here? So the ninth hole was supposed to be kind of a cape hole originally, and obviously he's used trees instead of like an out of bounds thing, but wanted it to be a cape hole. Was based on the first at Macrahanish. That's where he took his inspiration. What else have we got? The 13th is based on the 17th at Cypress Point. We've got the 16th hole. Now, the 16th hole is an interesting one. Obviously, the shorty par three with a lake to the left. Used to not be a lake. Used to be a creek, same creek as Ray's Creek. Used to run quite a thin creek. And the green was on the other side, and it was a Beerett's. It was on the left-hand side of that creek. And then they dammed it up and moved the green on the right-hand side. That was based on the 7th at Stoke Park.
This is crazy.
Right, I know. And then the 17th, you'll love this, Bruce. The 17th was loosely based on the 14th hole of the old played in reverse, which we have just had the opportunity to do not even a week ago. The 14th hole of the old, sorry, not the green, but the 14th hole of the old played in reverse.
Okay. I'm trying to get that. So that's playing to the fourth green.
I couldn't work it out. I tried hard.
Obviously,
it's boggling my mind. But a lot of inspiration, if anyone's interested in the evolution of this, again, couldn't plug it highly enough. Value 18 website. Joe McDonald and Jasper Miners, they do a fantastic job of quantifying. Yeah. In its entirety, it's increased 765 yards. Basically, it's about 40 yards a hole, though it's got longer. But lovely little Mackenzie quote, though, just to finish off on this. Excellence of design is merely felt rather than realized by the player. But nevertheless, it is constantly exercising a subconscious influence upon him. Just love that. Thought it was like, you just feel it. You don't even have to know it. You just feel it.
Yeah. It's kind of striking when you put it like that, how much the course has changed from that original vision that Jones and Mackenzie had. And it feels like maybe the emphasis is on the wrong stuff nowadays. It's understandable. Like, take the extension of the 13th hole, for example. It's like Augusta National, this, huge, hugely successful private club, just goes and buys some land from the golf course next door and, reroutes a road and it adds 50 yards on. And then I don't know if you've seen it. It's just been in the golf news or press this week about how that tea box, because they wanted to keep it very secluded and they haven't wanted to take out any of the big trees, and they wanted to basically maintain the width of that gap that you drive, that the professionals drive through off that tournament tee box, in order to make sure that the grass is of sufficient quality and it's not, you know, that it doesn't suffer because it doesn't get any sunlight, or it gets, you know, really sodden.
Yeah.
The temperature control, it might just get a bit of a heat trap. What they've done is they put pipes and sub air in that basically controls the temperature and the, you know, sort of moisture content of that tee box now against all sort of natural instincts, basically. And I feel like that has now become the focus. It's like, yeah, you know, they this sort of mythical conjecture about, oh, the trees are on tracks and they can push them back and forth, and they, you know, they put the ice, they put loads of ice on the azaleas so they don't come into bloom too early. Like, I feel like so much of the focus now is on that kind of that crazy stuff around the edges rather than the quality of the golf course. But hey,
yeah, well, I've got two thoughts on that. My first one is, I think there's kind of a pushback from the Augustification of golf, which happened in the 90s, yeah, the 2000s, that everything needs to be manicured and perfect. And I do feel like golf is pushing back a little and is accepting brown, yeah, accepting imperfection, which is good to see. All these things are cyclical, so who knows what will end up. Augusta's not cyclical. They will continually be icy azaleas and you know, hand cut and perfect, you know, perfectly manicured. And we give a lot of credit to Alison McKenzie, and so we should, but it was Alison McKenzie and Bobby Jones that put that together. And Bobby Jones was firmly of the belief that a par five should be reachable by two exceptional shots. So I find it interesting when I think about that we are in a position where the ball goes too far. We're in a position that they're bullying that hole where it doesn't take two magnificent shots to get on the green from the 13th at Augusta. So to extend the tee, I'm not massively averse to it. Like, I think they should just bring the ball back a bit more, and that would solve that. But the idea behind the hole is that two exceptional shots will get you on the green, and you can make an easy five if you want. So I don't know, like, you've got to try and stick to the authenticity of the design, haven't you? And because the tech is better. What's interesting is that shot heard around the world, the Albatross by Sarazen, was a 235-yard forward. And that seems like a long way, doesn't it?
Yeah, but what are guys hitting 235 yards now? They're probably at 5-iron.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. Well, if they had a forward and you're going into, again, a green that is as quick as it is today, and it's severely like pitched up and it's firmer, it's hard to compare, isn't it? But no, it's it kind of puts it in perspective.
That 15th green is class though, because it's got that, you've got the peril in front, which has always been there, that, and then that peril behind. So
you
that's
can run
why,
into the water the other side, yeah, definitely.
Yes, definitely. And it takes a genuinely miraculous shot if you're coming in from long distance to hold that green. Shall I tell you a little bit about the green jacket?
Yes, come on. Yeah, we've lingered there on the history stuff, which I can only apologize
for.
So let's get into the green jacket.
I haven't got to any of my six pages of notes yet, so we're probably
3 hour
35 minutes into this, but it's all good. Now, obviously, to state the obvious, green jackets are worn by members of Augusta National Golf Club and winners.
Yeah.
Now, the green jacket, the idea of the green jacket came in 1937. And this gives you an indication. Talking about the Alice McKenzie, you know, he died without being paid, died penniless, really. But in 1937, the reason the green jacket was brought in were so that members could be identified by members of the public, so they could ask for directions where to go. Can you imagine that now? Right, go stand out on the course and tell people where to go. Basically doing marshalling,
yeah,
you know. And that was the idea, was they wanted to be easily identifiable. It's reputably, I don't know if that's a word, based from when Bobby Jones was over at Royal Liverpool, 1930.
Yeah.
And the red hunting jackets that the captains wear at Royal Liverpool, and he thought was very smart, took that idea back to Clifford Roberts, but they couldn't decide on a color. for many years. They liked the idea, but couldn't really decide upon a color.
Didn't they get the wrong fabric as well? And it was like too uncomfortable and it was too warm or something.
Well, originally. It was a full on wool jacket that they're wearing in the Augusta heat. They weren't in love with the idea of it, but then they changed it to a polyester wool blend, which still continues to this day. And for those of you that are interested, they settled on the green, which the Pantone color for that is 342. If anyone's interested,
you 342. Amazing.
342 is the Pantone.
Everyone's going to get all mocked up. Put it out there. I did actually play in a corporate golf day last year. I got invited to, and I somehow managed to like win long drive there. And you can guess what the prize was for me winning long drive. It wasn't a box of golf balls or anything like that. It was a green jacket with the company logo on the breast, which was just the most corny thing ever. It wasn't Pantone 345 or whatever you just read out there. 342.
Well, I'm actually going to have to jump to the end of my green jacket notes here because this is a real pickle. Because in 2019, what time was it? In 2010, Augusta National trademarked green jacket.
Really?
So, and in 2019, they actually stopped Mullion Golf Club in Devon from awarding the club champ a green jacket. They put a cease and desist in. So you might have to give that long drive jacket back, Bruce, because they've got trademark on it now.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, you trademark the term green jacket or even a green jacket.
It's the corniest thing ever. Corporate golf days, you know, we probably used to just seeing that kind of stuff. It was the kind of day where you're just wearing team colors and you've all got your own like team nylon shirt. I know. So it was a sort of a highbrow golfing accolade. But Lucas Michel, friend of the pod, has won the Australian Master of the Amateurs once, maybe twice. And I remember he put up a post on his Instagram wearing a jacket. And I think it was around about the time that DJ had won. And he was wearing this jacket that, you know, Lucas is obviously quite a slim guy and was wearing this massive jacket that had Master of the Amateurs on it and looked like it still had the coat hanger in it. And he said, Dustin Johnson, any tips on tailoring? So that's the impact and legacy of Augusta though, right? Is like that green jacket is actually, you know, chucked around quite a bit.
It's a thing.
By golf clubs. It's a thing.
Yeah. And they were all originally made in size 40. So that's why everyone looks like they're 40 chests. So that's why everyone looks like this.
Really?
You know, these smaller golfers are swimming in them. But
so when did it first come in? For winners. So you mentioned that members had it in 1937, just to be identified.
37, yeah.
And who was the first champion to be awarded one?
The first champion was Sam Snead.
Yes.
To get the green jacket in 1949, which meant that basically there were 12 winners up until that point that didn't get green jackets.
But they were giving them retrospectively, weren't they? I think
assuming they were. I mean, yeah. It's kind of like, I honestly didn't go into whether they were given them retrospectively, but
it would suck if you didn't.
Feels like a thing, like, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
He'd seen everybody else do it. I mean, the winner, well, I mean, this has changed recently, but up until very recently, the winner was allowed to take home their green jacket for 1 year before they had to return it. And the only person that flat out refused, two people that flat out refused.
Oh, yeah.
It was Seve Ballesteros and Gary Player. And apparently, Gary Player said to Clifford Roberts phoned him up incandescent with rage. And he said, well, if you want it, you can come and get it. And he was living in South Africa and he called him in South Africa. He's like, if you want it, you can come and get it.
And he was the first international winner of the Masters, wasn't he? Overseas winner of the Masters. So maybe there was a bit more slack there.
Yeah, maybe.
But what's the story with Seve? Because wasn't there something about he got another one made that was like in the, you know, 3-4-2?
Well, I know that he kept
tried to hoodwink the club and left the real one in Spain or something.
Yeah, it's in Pedreña and infamously kept it. I mean, a former podcast guest, Martin Ebert, tells a story on the first time we did a podcast with him. He tells a story about when he first met his wife. His wife was like, oh, green jacket. Yeah, I've worn one of those. I wore one of those in Pedrenia. And he's like, no, you haven't. There's literally no green jacket. She's like, yeah, yeah, I've worn one at Pedrenia. And he basically, Martin called out his future wife as a liar, and actually turned out to be true that she had worn Seve's green jacket because he kept it at home in Pedrenia. But now, as of fairly recently, apparently they get a replica green jacket to keep so they can take off site.
Really? So that's what they wear on the talk shows. And it's a bit weird though, isn't it? It's like, because if you've got what's the difference between a replica and the real thing?
I don't know. This is the interesting
part. Not like the claret jug, is it? The claret jug is made out of like pure solid silver or some other very precious metal. You shouldn't be taking the real one of those around and drinking beer out of it. I can see that. But with the green jacket, it's like, what is the difference?
Well, this is the interesting part. The jackets don't even cost that much. So
really?
The jackets are made by the Hamilton Tailoring Company of Cincinnati, Ohio, and they cost $250. Wow. Up until very, very recently, there was one 500-yard piece of cloth that had cut every jacket.
That's amazing.
But when the introduction of lady members to Augusta National joined, there was a greater demand for this cloth, and they had to go away from that single piece of 500-yard fabric that they had originally made in, I think, in the 30s.
Sorry, I don't follow. So there are a lot of so with the admission of lady members to Augusta, the demand for that green cloth suddenly increased.
Look, I had a few hours to do these pod research, Bruce. That is as far as I got. And apparently they were, the tailoring company were reached out to by a local news agent and said, is there any specific design changes for lady members? Do they cut in, little different fit? And the response was no comment. So yeah. I'm assuming the answer
From the top, didn't it? Fred said,
But the fabric, for those of you who are interested, again, this Pantone 342, it's a lightweight tropical wood, lightweight tropical wool, and is made by Victor Fortsman Inc. textile mill. So if you want to contact them and get some fabric from them, you can make your own stuff out of it.
And this is different to the place. Sorry. Okay. So the jacket's actually made in Ohio, but the fabric is sourced from the mill.
This place,
Amazing.
Notable stories about the green jacket. In 1994, a Canadian journalist was in his local thrift store, which I suppose we would call a charity shop, and spotted a green jacket on a shelf and identified the logo and thought, I know what that looks a bit like. I know what that jacket looks a bit like. $5 it was up for sale. He purchased said jacket and did indeed end up being a Masters winner's jacket. Didn't find out whose it was, but immediately put it on auction and sold it for $139,000. That was in 1994.
That is unbelievable.
So,
wow, I feel like you couldn't get away with that nowadays.
Well, they were not happy. National, they were very not happy about this.
Do you think they're like Scotty Cameron circle tees, where you never actually buy a circle tee, you're just allowed to borrow it by the Acushnet company? It's that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't know how it works, but that was the end of my green jacket journey.
That was wonderful.
Mm.
That was wonderfully put together, Nils.
I've got a couple more things that we can talk about if you like.
Okay.
I suppose I know you've got one to talk about in a minute, but we're still early days in. We're establishing traditions here at Augusta National. So one of the traditions that was established earlier on was the champions dinner.
Yes.
Now, I thought, I'd just sort of dig away at the champions dinner and see when that sort of came about. And it was initiated in 1952 by...
I think I've read this before. I want to say Ben Hogan.
It is Ben Hogan.
Yeah, just wanted a proper Texan meal to...
Yeah. So initiated by Ben Hogan. And then for me, I mean, this is how thick I am. I was like, I started by Ben Hogan in 1952. And I was like, God, that must have been pretty boring. Who went to that? Because like, if he started it, he'd be the only person there, wouldn't he? Obviously didn't click. There was previous winners of the Masters. So yeah, we're starting in 1952. It's the annual gathering of winners of the Masters Tournament at Augusta National. In the first ever dinner, you had people like, do you know who won the first Masters, Bruce?
Yeah, you know what? For someone who's looked into the early history of the Masters, I really should know this.
It's not a name that would jump out.
1934.
Horton Smith.
Yeah, I knew it was an H. So yeah.
He was there. He attended the very first Champions Dinner. Gene Sowers and Byron Nelson, Sam Snead. Byron Nelson, flicking back just a little bit, had a little bit of to do with architecturally at Augusta National.
Yeah.
So when Clifford made the aforementioned disaster of the eighth green, it was Byron Nelson that's kind of helped to reinstate the mounding there and that par 5 eighth green. He also was partly to do with the damming of the 11th, you know, the pond that's now the back of the 11th.
Oh, okay.
The Rays Creek. Like that was Byron Nelson, Robert Trent Jones, and Clifford Roberts that kind of put their heads together and did that. But yeah, Byron Nelson, Sam Snead all attended the first Champions Dinner. How many Champions Dinners, how many hosts do you think there's been? Also, just to clarify for those that don't know, the winners host and they get to choose the menu and everything else. How many hosts do you think there's been? Essentially asking how many different winners.
So this year's the 88th playing of the Masters, isn't it? And then for the first 20 or so, slightly less, the it wasn't a tradition. So I'm going to say like 50, 55?
51.
Okay.
Very close, Bruce. Yeah. Because you've obviously got people that have won multiple as well. So Nicholas has won 6. Woods has won 5. Palmer's won 4.
Wow.
A couple of people won 3. But yeah, 51 different hosts. Honorable mentions, you know, for menus. So you can kind of see the growth in Tiger Woods from basically, you know, his growth as a human being on his menu choices between 1998 and 2019, you know, when he won those two Masters. In 1998, he was serving up cheeseburgers, chicken sandwiches, and milkshakes. I mean, Brilliant. He was still a child.
Yeah, he was 21 or so, wasn't he?
And then by 2019, you know, I honestly think this is symbolic of his personal growth. He was serving sushi and steak fajitas. You know, I think he's grown as a man. In his
didn't quite get to a proper steak. Still was in fajita form.
I'm pretty sure probably been some sort of wagyu or some tidy bit of steak.
Wow.
Other things, you know. Speaking of international winners, you got Adam Scott in 2014. He had a Australian. He was the first Australian to win the Masters. He did a typical Aussie barbecue.
That's awesome, yeah.
Which I thought was quite cool, with some Moreton Bay bugs, which I had to look at where they were. That's lobster. Lobster tends to be a theme of Champions dinners.
Even though, I mean, again, I can't imagine they're particularly frugal nowadays, especially given how much, you know, what's the first place prize now? It's got to be $1.5, $2 million probably for winning the Masters.
It's not as much as a live victory, I can tell you that.
Yeah, well, yeah. So if the champions menu comes off their bill, I mean, I can't imagine it's a big deal, but they certainly eat well, don't they, with lobster and steak and all the rest of it.
They're not messing around, are they?
There's a great photo of Faldo, actually, I think, from, I don't know which victory of his it was, where he served fish and chips and he's holding like...
Yeah, and there's a lot of that. Like, I think
fish and chips in the paper, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're expected to do a nod to your culture. I mean, Sergio had very typical Spanish cuisine. He had, you know, Spanish lobster. He had his mother's homemade apple fritter. Now, which begs the question, was his mother in the kitchen? I mean, how else is it his mother's homemade fritter?
Presume she gave away the recipe that was a sort of sacred family recipe.
You'd assume so. And Sandy Lyle, again, to go on that theme of nodding to your heritage, kind of caused a bit of a stir when in 1989 he served haggis, neeps, and tatties.
I knew he was going to get the haggis out. Yeah, of course. I wonder if there's been any like vegan winners of the Masters yet, or whether that will soon happen to be a thing. Like, it just... Overwhelmingly, there's a huge amount of meat on those menus, which are, you know, hey, I'm all for that. It all sounds bloody delicious, but there's the high meat content in the menus that I've seen from the past.
It would be interesting if Bryson, remember when Bryson declared it a par 68 for him or whatever? If he had won, 67. It would have been like
67 was it? Which, by the way, on that note, someone's kept a running tracker of like how many over par he is since he made that statement, and it makes for quite amusing reading. Sorry, carry on.
But if Bryson had won, you can imagine what he would have served. It would have been like, just at that time, he was on proper bulk mode, when it would have been like cyclone protein shakes and, you know, those sort of Caltine bars that get you 2,000 calories a bar. And that's it for part one of our podcast on the idiosyncrasies and traditions at Augusta National. This had no intention at the start of being a two-part series, but Bruce and I went on for about 90 minutes in total, so we decided to break it up into two. If you were interested and enjoyed part one, come back in a day or two for part two of the idiosyncrasies and traditions of Augusta National.
Watch this.